This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. Today, I have two very dear guests, Dr. Janelle Hope and Dr. Bill Mullen with us to talk about a wonderful book they have published or going to be released in a month soon. The book is called The Black Anti-Fascist Tradition, Fighting Back from Anti-Lynching to Abolition. The book is about the story of the fight against fascism across the African diaspora, revealing that the black anti-fascism has always been vital to global freedom struggles. Janelle and Bill, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
I think it's a very timely conversation. If I'm not mistaken, a couple of days ago, it was Du Bois' birthday.
Yes.
I'm sure we'll get to talk about him a little in the book. But before we start, can you briefly introduce yourself and tell us why you decided to write the book? What's the idea behind the book and how you managed to write the book together, given that you don't live in the same city? You're kind of far apart. So maybe Bill or Janelle, yeah?
I'll start. So thank you again for the opportunity to come share with your listeners a bit about the book. Bill and I are very excited about this project. We started, as Bill mentioned a little earlier, working on this project almost 4 years ago now. I am a scholar activist based out of Houston, Texas. A lot of my research had been around sort of Afro-Asian solidarity early on. And I first sort of came into contact with discussions on Black anti-fascism when I was studying the Black Panther Party, and they hosted this United Front Against Fascism conference. Fast forward some years, I was organizing in Sacramento and had been in network with folks who were who identified as Antifa. Fast forward two more years to 2020, and everything just sort of explodes in this moment, not only here in the US, but also globally, rallying around Black Lives Matter. And I began to see a lot of narratives within the media, particularly Black political pundits and media outlets, trying to distance Antifa, right, or anti-fascists from Black activists and organizers who were organizing in the name in the names of Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and many of the Black folks that summer of 2020 that were killed due to state-sanctioned violence. And so for me, I was like, well, we need to clarify this, right? Black folks have always been anti-fascist, and indeed, there's a tradition of this. And so that sparked an article that I wrote for Essence in 2020. And we got a lot of sort of engagement with it, right? Because I don't think any sort of mainstream press at the time was talking about how Black folks had been engaged in anti-fascist organizing. And so this piece kind of did that. I think Bill reached out to me as well as some other folks. Bill and I participated in a panel event. I think the Campus Anti-Fascist Network was hosting, and Bill was like, this should be a book. I had wrote a longer chapter of it for another anthology that has since come out, and someone else said, this should be a book. And so I said, okay, Bill, if it's a book, you want to write it with me? And he says, sure. And so, of course, we were amidst a pandemic. And so we began this process totally virtually online, collaborating through those early years of the pandemic, developing this project as a means to be able to reframe this narrative that Black people weren't a part of an anti-fascist tradition, and really trying to provide a historical narrative that actually proves the opposite of what many folks were purporting during that summer of 2020.
Great story. And Bill, how about you?
Yeah, I think the spark for me was reading Janelle's piece on the Black anti-fascist tradition, which gave our book its name. And I think I read it around 2019 or 2020. And I was at the time working on another book on fascism. It was a reader for Verso called U.S. Anti-Fascism. And we were trying in that reader to reflect like African diasporic points of view. So we had essays by people like Du Bois and George Padmore and folks we'll talk about tonight who are part of our book. And then I read Janelle's piece, which was kind of really talking about Black anti-fascism in the exact moment of 2020 and the George Floyd rebellions and Antifa. And it just clicked. Everything kind of came together for me thinking about this, what she called this tradition. So it was exciting to connect and start working on this. And, you know, I'm really, really excited with the way the book has come out.
Well, I was familiar with some famous Black activists, but the good thing about this book is that there are lots of names that I'm not a historian, I did not know. So it was a lot of useful information about this tradition of anti-fascism or the struggle of Black people for freedom, which is a global one, and we'll talk about it. But let's start with one character you talk about in the book, Ida B. Wells Barnett. Who was she? Tell us a little bit about her, and how did she become this architect of anti-lynching movement in the U.S.?
Absolutely. So we start the book with a chapter recasting Ida B. Wells as this, what we call a premature Black anti-fascist. And this is really drawing on the language of Robin D.G. Kelly and Cedric Robinson that talk about how Black folks had a premature understanding and analysis of fascism before it was being talked about within the context of Europe, right? And so Ida B. Wells, someone who was very well studied within Black studies, also within journalist spaces, at the time, really following Reconstruction, she emerges as a prominent journalist, Black journalist and educator with deep roots in Tennessee. She is among the first that begins to document the lynchings that are happening across the South. And her work, which is published in two key pamphlets that are talked about in the book, that's Red Record and Southern Horrors, becomes foundational for the anti-lynching movement. And so she would also go on to help be one of the early founders of the NAACP and the National Association for Colored Women. These two groups are important because they would also take up the cause of anti-lynching in their advocacy and sort of activism work, right? Many of them were pushing for anti-lynching legislation. And Wells Barnett would say, we need to push for anti-lynching legislation, endeavor into self-defense, Right. And then also begin to tell our counter narratives to challenge the sort of white press and local law enforcement that were very dismissive of this epidemic of lynchings that were occurring in this immediate sort of post-Reconstruction era. And so Ida B. Wells is this figure that's very central to the formation of these key organizations and this push to challenge lynchings. Right. Moreover, her research becomes sort of reverberated across many of the later chapters that we'll talk about, right? So her work is picked up by the Civil Rights Congress. Du Bois engages some of her work. Frederick Douglass engages some of her work as they all are trying to figure out what does life for Black folks look like in these immediate sort of post-slavery and post-Reconstruction years. And the phenomenon of lynching is there, right? But beyond lynching, what we argue in the book is that Ida B. Wells was also interested in trying to piece together what she called this conspiracy, right? And so she's saying it's the lynchings, but it's also the fact that Black people are being treated like a second-class citizen. They aren't receiving justice in the courts, right? The courts, the judges, the law enforcement from the state, all the way up to the federal government, all the way back down to the county are all in cahoots with one another, right? And so she names this conspiracy that we sort of begin to talk about as the foundation of anti-Black fascism in the United States, right? She's understanding that everything is working together. The law, law enforcement, these sort of vigilantes like the KKK are working together to create this Black terror, this terror for Black people and Black communities, right? And so in addition to her being this mother of anti-lynching and pioneer within the NAACP, for us, she is also a significant person who really sorts to endeavor into one of the early mass movements around Black anti-fascism, and that is the anti-lynching movement.
The one thing I'll just add to what Janelle said is that Wells was also paying attention to the anti-Jewish pogroms that were taking place in Europe in the early 20th century. And this is a theme of our book, which is that Black anti-fascists in the United States are always paying attention to genocides and fascist movements outside of the U.S. When Du Bois himself goes to Germany in the early 1930s, just as Hitler's trying to rise to power. And a lot of folks just don't understand that piece of Black radicalism, how internationalist Black folks have been, and how they have always been, as Janelle kind of put it, prematurely aware of things like pogroms, because when you live in the South, you know, you're undergoing pogroms yourself, you know, under lynchings. So that was for us a really important connection to make.
Yeah, she has this really scathing critique of U.S. Sort of policy at the time that is, you know, wagging its hand at the pogroms of Russian Jews, I think is how she puts it, in Southern Horrors. And she's like, how dare, like, we talk about what's happening over there to Russian Jews, but not also see the violence of what's happening here in the American South, right? And so we see this, a lot of the sort of rhetoric with regards to how we talk about and language of how we talk about fascism within Europe being echoed in the writings of many of the Black anti-fascists we talk about in the book.
And based on this said, so this anti-lynching movement sort of for the basis of this Black anti-fascist resistance. And I'm interested also to know more about how it kind of evolved and created this social or political organizing, help people do political and social organizing.
Absolutely. So one thing to also think about is Wells's work also sets the stage for the Civil Rights Congress to even be able to charge the United States with genocide, right? We'll get to a discussion on William Patterson, the United Nations case charging the United States with genocide. But lynchings represent the early sort of incidents of mass Black death following slavery, right? And it is the documenting of these lynchings, right? Which is the precipice of this case for that many people argue that Black people have been subjected to a slow death, a type of genocide within this country, right? And so we go from Ida B. Wells Burnett to the Civil Rights Congress, Later on, we'll talk about Angela Davis and mass incarceration, right? But there's this long trajectory of folks arguing, right? Even all the way up to the We Charge Genocide sort of youth group that comes out of the Black Lives Matter movement, that are all drawing upon this history of just Black violence and Black death, starting with lynchings through mass incarceration, through police brutality and state-sanctioned violence, right? And so Wells Barnett is very much the start of that.
In fact, one of the keynote themes of our book is we talk about what we call anti-Black fascism. And we argue that fascism always has had an anti-Black dimension. And these Black anti-fascists that we're writing about were the first people to kind of recognize this and articulate it. And now we're kind of sort of more comfortable talking about anti-Blackness as a long part of Western history, but it's also a long part of fascism's history.
And Bill, you mentioned some of the, like Du Bois, for example, when it was in Germany. So I'm also interested to know how this Black anti-fascist movement become global. How was it entangled with fight against fascism in general, not only in the United States, but also in Europe?
There's a couple of ways to think about that. I mean, several of the people that we use as foundational thinkers on the history of fascism point to the role of colonialism in Africa and Asia as a foreshadowing of the politics and the techniques of fascism. The German state in Southwest Africa at the turn of the century is creating internment camps that really become the prototype, okay, against Africans for what happens to the Jews in the 1930s. People like Du Bois were paying attention to this when it was happening in 1905. Mm-hmm. He was seeing, he says, the future kind of atrocities and terror that is being used against Africans now is likely going to be the form of warfare going forward. That's such a powerful, like, premature understanding of techniques of fascism, we could call mm-hmm. them, which colonialism masters and experiments with. And that's really the heart of Aimé Césaire's brilliant essay, Discourse on Colonialism, in 1950, where he looks back at the history of colonialism. This is after the Holocaust. And he says, you know, really, the Holocaust was just colonialism coming home to roost here in Europe against a white population, right? Mm-hmm. So in a sense, fascism was global always for Black anti-fascists, beginning in places like Africa and predicting the shape of future wars. And the other thing I would say about this is Ethiopia plays a huge role in the history of Black anti-fascism, because in 1935, when fascist Italy under Mussolini invades Ethiopia, it begins to use terrorism and genocidal tactics and internment camps against the Ethiopian population there. From London, where George Padmore and C.L.R. James, who are both Black radicals, are organizing, to like New York, where James Yates, who is a Southerner transplanted from the South, who's come up to New York, in 1935, it's hands off Ethiopia. That's the mm-hmm. cry in the diaspora from the Caribbean to the United States. And that's so important to think about, because we make the argument that the Black anti-fascist tradition has always been a global tradition. It's not mm-hmm. centered in Germany. It's not centered in France. It's not centered in New York. It's actually a diasporic phenomena, right? Absolutely. That because these Black anti-fascists see the diaspora as one of the producers and targets of fascism across the last, 200 years.
Mm-hmm. I would, that was a great Bill. The only thing that I would add is coming back to the Black international piece that we were talking a little bit earlier. I think about what's the book Radicals on the Road, and how travel is also so important. And so some figures that also come up in the book are folks like Paul Robeson, right? Folks like Harry Haywood, Langston Hughes, Jackie Orms. These were folks who oftentimes traveled, and they also got to see fascism at work in Europe, either because they were traveling as artists, right? Or they were traveling because they served in the military in Ethiopia, or thinking about later when we start talking about the double POV campaign in World War II. So these folks were also acutely aware of, as Bill talked about, sort of these international struggles that are happening. And so they're forming their analysis of anti-Black fascism as it's happening in the United States, drawing upon what they're seeing when they end up in Germany, when they end up in Spain, when they end up in Ethiopia, and so forth.
And I think with Paul Robeson, I've recently been reading more about him. They confiscated his passport at some time in the United States. They didn't let him travel. Mm-hmm. And there's this famous video of him, I think, which kind of went viral, that he's in England, Scotland. I'm not really sure that he's singing for minors. He's singing a very famous song for minors. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, how did the first, let's say, mass popular anti-fascist movement, African, how did African Americans form that? When did it happen? How did it manage to form that first mass anti-fascist movement?
I think there's two ways to think about that. One is that 1930s campaign, Hands Off Ethiopia, which was really popular in Harlem. There were huge street demonstrations. I mean, we're talking about thousands of people, ordinary Harlemites coming out to say, you know, Italy's got to get out of Ethiopia, and the United States should give no cover and no support, even though it did, to the Italian regime. And that's the beginnings of a grassroots anti-fascism that kind of sweeps across the country. I mean, St. Louis and Chicago, you're seeing similar kinds of demonstrations. You're seeing Black theater groups beginning to produce plays about Ethiopia, right? Because they're trying to bring cultural consciousness to bear. Paul Robeson starts talking, says that the role of the artist is to be against fascism. I mean, he's one of the most popular entertainers in the United States in the 1930s and the 40s. People forget, before the Cold War started, he was on the radio all the time, right? He was performing at Carnegie Hall. I mean, he was on the stage in New York City. So he was trying to make a Black art, right? Mobilize Black art in the name of a popular anti-fascism. And the second piece of it, I would say, is during World War II, when Black newspapers really take a strong role in opposing fascism. And they come up with this campaign that we talk about a lot in our book called the Double Victory Campaign. Mm-hmm. And it meant, you know, the responsibility of every Black American is to fight fascism abroad and fight racism at home. And that was, they were trying to say those things were different but overlapping phenomenon, right? Because there were Dixiecrat Southern senators during World War II showing admiration for Hitler, saying that white supremacy was a natural good, that Black people were inferior. So it wasn't a big stretch to say you need a double victory. And this is kind of like a mass movement against a homegrown fascism led by newspapers who, you know, everybody can read. I mean, that was, to me, one of the most powerful things about the history of the Black press is you didn't, ordinary folks picked up the Pittsburgh Courier or the Amsterdam News every day and thought through the problems of the time. So those were some ways in which I think Black anti-fascism became popular and popularized.
And in a way, I guess what you said happened back then sounds very, very familiar and similar to what's happening right now again in the United States and other parts of the world as well, with what's happening in Palestine and people asking the United States not to fund Israel to bomb people in Palestine. Yeah. And you talk about double victory campaign. What kind of campaign was it? How did it tie itself with Black radicalism? Was it a militant movement? Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, certainly. As Bill mentions, this really is a campaign that comes out of the Black press, particularly the Pittsburgh Courier at the time. And so as Black service members are going abroad and literally fighting in Germany and are charged with defeating fascism in Europe, the Black press is also trying to galvanize folks who are at home to combat Jim Crow, right? To combat Jim Crow, but also just racial inequality that's happening across both the North and the South. And so what this looks like, and I think is some really cool pieces to the book, is that there's this major cultural front that happens. And so you get artists like Jackie Orms who begin to sort of bring out major themes of anti-fascism within the cartoons. Bill looks at some of Langston Hughes's poetry, right, during his Double Victory era, that is very much anti-fascist in its in its tone, right? And so we see how the insertion of these pieces of culture and art within newspapers is also influencing Black folks at home's sort of motivations to be able to assert, you know, we need to end Jim Crow. And obviously this would eventually segue into much of the civil rights and later Black power organizing that we talk about in the book and that would happen within that period.
You know, when you ask if it was radical, I mean, one thing I would link to this is anti-fascism was also anti-colonial. And in the 1930s and the 1940s, people like Langston Hughes and Paul Robeson and George Padmore and C.L.R. James were making that connection. They were saying these countries that are going fascist, like Germany and Italy, they're also long-standing colonial states that have already conquered Africa and are still there. And so that was a very powerful conjuncture. I mean, in our reading of it, the Black anti-fascist movement that links to anti-colonialism in the 30s and the 40s helps us understand why decolonization happens after World War II. It's the building of a movement against white supremacy, against colonialism, against authoritarian regimes that has at the baseline a freedom message, and meaning Africa must be free. This is what Robeson kept saying. He said, if we can defeat Nazi Germany, maybe then we can think about, you know, liberating some of these African countries that need to be free too.
And what kind of people, you mentioned some artists, authors that joined this campaign, but in general, what kind of people were gravitated towards this campaign or this movement?
Go ahead, Bill. No, go ahead.
Almost every major Black writer from this period, just to take an example, Langston Hughes, Richard Wright, let's see, who else can I think of? Ollie Harrington, who was a cartoonist, right, for the Black press, Paul Robeson, the singer, people like Lena Horne, you know, were on the edges of what we would think of as popular anti-fascism in the 1940s and the 1950s. And then, you know, I mentioned the size of these rallies that were taking place in cities like New York. The Black press, which had a huge circulation during the 40s, and especially it was the high point of circulation of Black newspapers in this country. They were constantly putting out the call for these demonstrations in the streets. And so anti-fascism was kind of like your daily bread, you know, for folks, because it was part of their orientation to the world that was being promoted and advanced by people who were producing their newspapers, their magazines, their music, their theater. It was sort of everywhere.
I wanted Bill to go first because I want to shift the conversation a little bit, because it's certainly what's happening in the newspapers, the cultural front, what's happening with Black soldiers that are abroad. But also during this time period, a major case is brought forward, and that is the trial of the Scottsboro Boys. And this is a case that many African-Americans rallied around. I mean, this is a sort of a pre-Emmett Till case, right? And you have these young Black men and boys that are accused of some sort of sexual act and don't get justice, right? This case is important, right? It happens in the 1930s because it is a moment where we see folks rally around challenging the law, right? So we see folks like William Patterson, the Civil Rights Congress, and other folks involved in attempting to challenge, right, the prosecution of the Scottsboro Boys, and also naming this as like an act of anti-Black fascism, right? And so this case becomes very important. And so when you talk about, well, is this moment militant? Is it radical? I think something that we talk about in the book is a tactic of a practice of legal anti-fascism, right? In challenging the law itself. And so a major argument that we make in the book is that fascism is indeed baked into the very law, a very American law, and how Black people are treated from slave codes to Jim Crow laws, this whole dual application of the law that Black people are experiencing during this period is important to challenge. And the Scottsboro Boys case becomes one of those early prominent cases that seeks to do that.
Yeah, one more thing about your question about was the movement radical. So William Patterson, who Janelle talked about, was a communist, and he worked for something called the International Labor Defense, and he was a hired lawyer, hired by the Communist Party to defend the Scottsboro Boys. He's also, 10 years later, the architect of the We Charge Genocide mm-hmm. petition that it's brought to the United Nations, accusing the U.S. of long histories of genocide against Black folks. And then in the late 1960s, he's helping Angela Davis try to get free from prison when she is herself beginning to theorize the meaning of fascism from her prison cell. So there's the specter of Black communism is also a theme of our book, and the way that mm-hmm. somebody like Patterson mm-hmm. carries forward for really 30 years long standing a critique of fascism, both in its manifestations in Europe, because he also went to Germany in the 1930s to see what was going on, but also articulating anti-Black fascism here at home. And Janelle's right. It's for him, it starts with the Scottsboro Boys. He writes a story in the papers comparing the treatment of the Scottsboro Boys to Jews who were being locked up in 1933 in German prisons. He sees the analogy very, very clearly. Or that's for him the way fascism begins to come into focus.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to unpack some of those things that you just mentioned. Can you talk about that Civil Rights Congress campaign to indict the United States and how it's posing a threat to Black Americans?
Sure. I think I want to take it back just a little bit and talk about how the book does a really good sort of critical analysis of fascism and the law, right? So we start the book in talking about how many of these early slave codes, Jim Crow laws, are used and replicated in Nazi Germany and in Italy, right? They directly inform the Nuremberg laws. They directly inform the Italian race codes. And so it becomes immediately present for a lot of the Black anti-fascists that we talk about in the book that the law itself is fascist and it has to be challenged, right? And so we started with talking about Wells and her documenting of lynchings. Much of that work is really kind of handed down generation to generation. And William Patterson becomes this central figure. He isn't the only one, who's participating in this. There are many folks across the Civil Rights Congress. And actually there were many iterations. There was the earlier version of SNCC, a youth communist group, right? There's the Negro Congress. There are these different groups that take up this sort of the anti-lynching work, right? And formulate it into a larger petition where you have the United Nations that's recently formed after the end of World War II, and also this genocide convention. And so William Patterson has this idea with other folks who are part of the Civil Rights Congress to say, how about we leverage these international bodies to draw attention to what Black folks are experiencing, which is very much reminiscent to what Jewish people in Germany and in Italy had just undergone, right? And so they put together this major petition charging the United States with genocide. Within that, certainly are cases of lynchings, certainly are cases of Black people being discriminated for job opportunities, overall sort of sweeping studies of the Black experience, painting it as one of a second class citizenry, right? That really has been subjected to a life of misery, right? This petition makes its way up to the United Nations sort of genocide body that has just been formed. And of course, it receives lots of sort of backlash, right? The United States attempts to use folks within the NAACP to try and minimize, right, what the experiences of Black folks are. In many ways of what we're seeing happening today within the United Nations, leveraging its sort of veto power in sort of discussions around a ceasefire for Palestine. Essentially, the petition is ultimately like dismissed, right, within this international governing body. However, its legacy lives on, right? We Charge Genocide literally becomes a rallying cry, right? It's a rallying cry that Stokely Carmichael would pick up, that Angela Davis would pick up, and that really is stewarded by William Patterson, as Bill mentioned, right, who is helping Angela Davis out in her trial, who was active within sort of the legal workings of the Black Panther Party. We Charge Genocide becomes a sort of rallying cry throughout generations, and also within a Chicago-based organizing group that formed in the 2010s following the killing of Mike Brown, right? They also turned to this international body saying, hey, these more contemporary incidents of state-sanctioned violence against Black people is another iteration of genocide, right? In this long history, right? So while the petition doesn't go far with the internet within this international body, it does create this long tradition for folks to be able to use this foundational work to continue to engage in Black anti-fascist organizing.
And one of the books that was important to us when we were doing our thinking about this is a book by a legal scholar named James Whitman called Hitler's American Model. And he documents in great detail how during the 1930s, most of the Nazi jurists used American race law and Jim Crow law and laws against Native Americans to formulate things like the Nuremberg Codes and all of the anti-Jewish laws that became foundational to the Third Reich. Well, that's a way of saying that Ida B. Wells was right. In other words, she was prematurely aware of exactly how these laws, American laws, could be incipient fascism, right? And this is something that we try to talk about in our book. It's like, well, people say fascism has to have five characteristics, and you have to, and it. Angela Davis said fascism is a process, and what she means, it's a historical process. It's an accumulation of ideas and techniques that are used against a population based on their race, ethnicity, or nationality. That's really at the heart of the We Charge Genocide petition, which says, if you look at 200 years of American history, you have torture, lynchings, police shootings, hangings, mass killings, unequal health conditions. It's they use the term premature death to describe the genocidal conditions of America. And it's interesting to me that one of our greatest contemporary thinkers, Ruthie Gilmore, actually defines racism as unequal vulnerability to premature death. It's almost like she's picking up on like a very important current in the theorization of genocide and fascism as it's come down to us by Black radical thinkers.
So we have talked about this Black anti-fascist movement, some of the key figures. You have mentioned Angela Davis, but we haven't really talked about her. Where does she come in? What is the role of her writings and her activism in tackling anti-Black fascism?
Yeah, so Angela Davis's work comes in towards, I would say, the second half of the book. Bill and I both, we talked about how one of her most slept on books is If They Come in the Morning. And it's this anthology of political prisoners from the 1970s period, you know, immediately following her incarceration. And in this piece, many folks are critiquing the carceral state as well as anti-Black fascism. And so where Angela Davis becomes central in this piece, particularly, is I began to put her in conversation with one of her comrades, George Jackson, right? So George Jackson, also a political prisoner incarcerated in California at the time. He's also writing about the state of anti-Black fascism. And by the time we get to the 1970s, right? So we have to think, if we take it back a few years, in 1969, the Black Panther Party has had this United Front Against Fascism conference in Oakland in the summer of 69. They have named that fascism is one of the great, represents the greatest threats towards Black folks and folks on the left. In their newspaper, they're using rhetoric that draws upon fascist sort of retorts and language. So the use of genocide, pogroms, all that is sort of echoed. Pigs become fascist pigs. Corporate landlords become, you know, fascist landlords. So they really have helped to reframe an understanding of what fascism is during the sort of 1960s, 1970s period. What we argue in the book is that by the time you get to examining the works of many of these political prisoner intellectuals, Davis becomes one, George Jackson is also one, they are honing in even more on a insidious element of anti-Black fascism, and that is the carceral state and what we began to see as the rise in mass incarceration, right? And so they argue that Black people, again, are experiencing this long sort of legacy of genocide, and slavery and bondage and prisons are also wrapped up in that. Right. I pivot and I look at George Jackson's work because for me, he has some of the sharpest sort of class analysis around fascism. Right. How many of the Black anti-fascists that we talk about within the book are talking about fascism is largely through race, largely through gender, right? Understanding that natalism is a project within fascism, understanding the anti-democraticness of fascism, understanding the far right sort of elements of fascism. But for George Jackson, he's very keen on the economic sort of the period of the 1970s and eventually what would be the 1980s. And he calls it this rise of corporativism. Right. He uses the term corporativism, fascism. Right. And essentially what he's doing is he's looking at how racial capitalism, right, will only be furthered and grow during this period of neoliberalism and really sort of this rise of shareholder profits and many of the sort of economic elements that we see at work today that are disproportionately impacting working class people, right? And so he says this will be another sort of nail in the sort of fascist foundation within this country. We really need to be concerned about this shift towards corporativism, this deregulation, the sort of slashing of taxes and how that will impact Black people, right? And so in the chapter, I sort of talk about how George Jackson is almost sort of prematurely seeing the outcomes that will be laid out in the Powell Memorandum. And so that's where Angela Davis comes in, right? We're putting her into conversation with these other folks who are incarcerated, also thinking of Lorenzo Comboa Irvin, right, who I talk about is this Black anarchist who's also incarcerated and is writing about fascism while in prison, right? Beyond this piece on sort of political prisoner intellectuals and how they're writing about Black anti-fascism and anti-Black fascism, we bring Davis in towards the latter end of the work because obviously Davis is highly regarded for her work on abolition, right, and her call to abolish prisons. And so we see abolition as both the beginning and the current of a Black anti-fascist struggle. It is the abolition of slavery and more contemporary cause to abolish prisons, police, and other institutions that have indeed oppressed Black life as being integral to fully dismantling anti-Black fascism in this country and globally as well. So that's where Angela Davis comes in. She comes in at several points of the book, but really that those I would say those last three chapters, and really honing in on her If They Come in the Morning anthology, which is a really good book that again it gets slept on.
That was great. And I'll just add one thing that about Davis. You know, she and George Jackson were correspondents and co-theorists. He was more convinced that fascism had come. She was really focusing on this process of increasing use of the law and prisons, as Janelle's talked about, and basically said, you know, she said something at one point, she said, I think around 2000, she said, I never thought we'd get to 2 million people in American prisons unless fascism had come. Now, she still wasn't saying fascism had come, but she was focusing in on this unequal lineage of Black incarceration as a sign and a symptom of a kind of form of legal quasi-fascism that Black folks were living under. And I think the other piece that interests me about her, she was in grad school around the time that all hell broke loose at the University of California, San Diego, studying with Herbert Marcuse, who was a German Frankfurt School thinker and Marxist. And he was developing, and she was developing with him, this idea that fascism was what Marcuse called preventive counter-revolution. And what it meant was the way that the state and capitalism would conspire to make sure that revolution could never happen. Well, when you're in a revolutionary moment, like Angela Davis was in 1969 and 1970, this was another meaningful way to think about fascism as that which made massive social change impossible. And of course, because they were coming, partly because I think they were coming out of a Marxist tradition, they knew that fascism in Italy and Germany had both been counter-revolutionary projects. They were meant to destroy communist parties. They were meant to destroy workers' movements. They were a response to the Russian Revolution. So because they identified with that tradition, that theory of fascism as preventive counter-revolution, I think, is another important contribution that Davis brought to the Black anti-fascist tradition.
Mm-hmm. What about anarchist theories? What was the role of anarchist theories and also maybe direct action reforms in Black anti-fascism? And again, talking about new characters, new people that I didn't know when I came across in the book, there's this person you talk about, Asata Shakur. What was her contribution to Black fascism? So yeah. I guess the question is two parts here.
So it's a really good question. So by the time we get to early 1970s, really 72, the Black Panther Party is all but on the decline for many reasons. But one of the major reasons was that many of the members had grown disillusioned with the party's shift towards electoral politics. And so there are many members, particularly those on the East Coast, in New Jersey, and in New York City, that band together, and they really organize around anarchy. Right. These are folks who are invested in revolutionary violence, and they form a group called the Black Liberation Army, for which Asata Shakur is a member of, Kwasi Balogun, Ashanti Alston, and some other folks that we talk about in the book. These are folks who are committed to challenging the foundations of anti-Black fascism, particularly the capitalist elements of it, through what they would call reappropriations or bank heists. They were involved in several plane hijackings, several alleged shootouts, and notoriously several prison escapes, for which Asata Shakur was freed and liberated in one, right? She to this day is in exile in Cuba. And so Asata Shakur enters the book as this character because during the time we were writing, I had resat with her autobiography, which is a classic, right? It's a classic autobiography of this period of folks. And in the early chapters, as Asata is reflecting upon her time, I believe she's in a prison in New Jersey, she talks about almost this sort of psychological torture that she begins to experience from some of the prison guards. She talks about how these prison guards are wearing clothes that resemble or uniforms that resemble sort of Nazi soldiers. She talks about hearing these prison guards talk about Cher that, you know, Hitler is right and making Hitler was right and making use of sort of the N-word and things like that. And so she has these very vivid writings about her experience in prison being very similar to or echoing and reverberating sort of aspects of fascism in Europe, right? And seeing these police guards, right? These prison guards have these, carry these sort of fascistic sentiments, right? And so for Asada, who had come up in the Black Panther Party, both in Oakland and New York, to go from just chants of, you know, fascist pigs to actually now being in prison and seeing sort of fascism reverberate in this space as she's sort of psychologically being tortured, becomes a element that we talk about within the text, right? Alongside this sort of anarchist practice that emerges out of the BLA, right? And that is not enough to just turn to electoral politics or even do mutual aid, which we talk about in the book as inherently being anti-fascist work. When the government does not step in to support its people and communities have to form their own networks of radical care, that is inherently anti-fascist work. But for folks like the BLA, that was not enough. They no longer desired to be reactionary, right? These were folks who actually wanted to be antagonists, right? And so what we also see continuing within this tradition of political prisoners who are writing is that they also began to theorize on what Black anarchy looks like. And so there's a really cool chapter in the book where we talk about Lorenzo Comboa Irvin, who is one of the sort of pioneers in writing around sort of Black anarchisms and theorizing around Black anarchisms. Moreover, what we see come out of this sort of Black anarchist tradition and this period of the 1970s and 80s is also new tactics, right? That really went beyond the tactics of the Black Power era. So certainly building upon mutual aid, thinking about the anarchist tactics that I mentioned a little bit earlier in terms of the reappropriations, these sort of prison breaks, revolutionary violence. I'm thinking about Mike Davis's work as well, who talks about revolutionary terrorism. Also thinking about autonomous zones, like autonomy becomes very big. If we think back to 2020 and think about the Capitol Hill autonomous zone that was created, we think of the work of Cooperation Jackson and Malcolm X Grassroots and the work that folks have been doing in Jackson, Mississippi to try and create an autonomous self-governed Black community, right? Autonomy becomes this sort of tactic or strategy for Black anti-fascist sort of work during this period, right? And so that is where sort of anarchy, Asada, and all these things come into play. Hopefully that answered the question pretty well.
I want to pick up on one of the threads that Janelle talked about, which is another thread in our book, when she was talking about the Black Liberation Army and use of direct action, resistance and self-defense. You know, in the scholarship on fascism, there's a lot of attention rightly paid to things like the Warsaw Ghetto Uprisings or the French Underground Resistance, where you had people putting their lives on the line, arming themselves to resist fascism. We have a chapter about the Abraham Lincoln Brigades in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. And these were people from all over the world who signed up to go to Spain and fight against the Franco regime. And about 100 African-Americans went. And they went to fight, and they went to bear arms, and they were militarizing their resistance to fascism. And this is really important because, first of all, if you were in an American army at that time, you were fighting in a Jim Crow army. You were fighting in a segregated army. These were integrated, interracial, anti-fascist, self-defense brigades. And mm-hmm. that model really carries forward for a long time. We write about a man, Janelle writes about a guy named Robert F. Williams, who did some time in the military and in the 1950s started to advocate for armed self-defense of Black folks in the South in the face of these lynchings that Ida B. Wells had been writing about 50 years earlier He writes a book called Negroes with Guns in 1963 that has a huge influence on the Black Panther Party, which is called the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. And of course, you know, by the late 1960s, the Panthers are walking around Oakland carrying guns. Well, this is a kind of long tradition of self-organizing, self-defense, militarized resistance to fascism, which is often celebrated, as it should be in other anti-fascist traditions. But we think it's a very strong current in the Black anti-fascist tradition as well.
Yeah, Bill bringing up Robert F. Williams is also a key person in the book, right? I think I retell the story of how Robert F. Williams is listening to the radio with his grandmother, and it's all the happenings of what's happening in Germany and Hitler. And so very early on, Robert F. Williams has this, you know, attuned ear to fascism. Years later, he would advocate for self-defense, help form one of the first Black NRA gun groups, right? And then in his newspaper, The Crusader, he really introduces the term American fascism. And that becomes a recurring topic throughout The Crusader for years, right? And he's also this internationalist in part because he's in exile, right? So he's in Cuba, he's in China. So he has also this very attuned sort of viewpoint on what fascism can looks like abroad, and also what are the struggles of black people across the global South.
We have touched upon the topic of colonization as well, and I don't think we can kind of separate fascism from colonization. I'm interested to know more about the interconnection, also some key figures that you discuss in the book, such as Frantz Fanon or Aimé Césaire, that their role in this movement. The anti-Black fascism.
So out the gate, Bill and I both were like, Fanon and Aimé Césaire are part of this foundation of how we even come to understand and put together naming anti-Black fascism, right? I think it's in, and I'm actually rereading The Wretched of the Earth this semester with my students. We have just got through the chapter where he goes through like these 15 case studies on like the psychological impacts of colonialism. And it was a very rough day getting through that yesterday with them. But for us, it's the quote of Césaire where he says like the daily barbarisms of colonialism was really just, or fascism was the daily barbarisms of colonialism practiced on European people, right? That's it, right? We understand colonialism and settler colonialism, right? I think it's important to name both of them as part and parcel of fascism, right? Mm-hmm. Colonialism in and of itself being brutal, violent, as Fanon lays out the violence in multiple sort of areas, authoritarian, anti-democratic in nature, built upon racial capitalism and just inherently exploitative, right? When Fanon gets into discussing sort of the gendered violence, right? It's inherently sort of sexist. We understand how rape is used as a tool of violence and colonialism, right? It sort of hit colonialism, hits many of the elements of fascism that we outline in our book, right? And so there is, as you said, as you so brilliantly said, there is no separating fascism from colonialism. In many ways, they operate as one and the same.
Yeah, I was going to give an example of Langston Hughes, the poet who goes to Spain because he wants to understand the plight of the Moors. These are dark-skinned North Africans that are in basically colonized Spanish subjects who are being brought to the front lines and used as like cannon fodder. And he sees this as fascism and colonialism co-constituting each other. And he reports on this for the Black press. He writes some really brilliant articles and poems about this. Or I mentioned Du Bois earlier, who in 1915 in this essay called The World in Africa, says that, you know, the root of World War One is the battle for the colonies in Africa. Well, in the 1930s, when Hitler rises to power, one of the things that he uses as a rallying cry is the fact that after World War One and the Treaty of Versailles, you know, Germany didn't get as big a cut of the colonial pie. He said that will never happen again. So literally, he's invoking German colonialism as a motivation for the rise of the Third Reich. And we find over and over that people like Césaire and Du Bois and C.L.R. James and Padmore and Angela Davis, I mean, in the 1960s, you know, Angela Davis says, well, we may not have fascism yet, but look what they're doing to the Vietnamese. We could be next, right? She's watching, you know, napalm being used, carpet bombing of non-white populations, right? Again, this identifying of techniques and historical processes that she recognizes has have been used and will be used again on our own people, right? So I think what our book is trying to do is kind of reframe fascism from the Global South perspective, to look at it more from the standpoint of its victims, and to kind of take the narrow focus away from Europe and Western European history in particular as the only place you can ever look for fascism. That's clearly never been the understanding in the Black anti-fascist tradition.
I think the book in this moment also really serves as this clarion call, right? The Black anti-fascists don't exist in this moment, don't exist in a vacuum, right? We understand that anti-Black fascism is running amok here. You've got fascism that was taking root in Brazil. We'll see how what's happening with Lula and if some of that is being able to be recoiled. You've got fascism taking root in India. You've got fascism taking root all across really the world. Duterte in the Philippines, right? And so this book becomes a clarion call that yes, fascism doesn't just happen in Europe. No, you don't need just, you know, a singular authoritarian sort of dictator-like figure for you to have fascism. I think I talked about it at ASA, is like fascism is this creep, right? You'll see pieces of it, you'll see elements of it, and before you know it, it's all there. And I think in talking through Angela Davis, right? I remember reading she talked about a South African style fascism, right? In the 80s and talking about 80s and talking about South African apartheid. There's a creep. You see pieces of it globally. And so this book tries to bring a lot of it together, while it is largely focused on the Black diasporic experience. You can draw very similar analogies to the experiences of people in Puerto Rico, right? We talk about, you know, how primarily Jim Crow laws and slave codes are used as the basis for anti-Black fascist laws, but you can make the same case about the Chinese Exclusion Act, right? Fascism has been embedded and shaped the experiences of many people of color, non-white people globally, folks across the Global South. And so we hope this book is something that helps folks wake up and understand that and organize it in contest against fascism.
Thank you, Jen. That was actually my next question, which you beautifully answered. And I was reminded of, when I was reading, going through the book, preparing myself for the interview, I was kind of reminded of James Baldwin, who is, I guess, Bill Mullen's hero as well. Right? So I think I watched an interview with him some time ago. The interviewer asked him about homosexuality, that for a moment it went away. And then James Baldwin says, no, it never went anywhere. It was just there, but we didn't see it. And I wanted to talk about rise of fascism in the past few years. But then the truth is that no, it never went away. It was still there, but maybe in a more silent form, but it really never went anywhere. And I wanted to ask about the importance of the lessons, let's say, the Black anti-fascism can have, which you beautifully answered. Is there anything else in terms of like lessons we can learn? Because it's not only an American thing, like you said, it's fascism is rising everywhere in the world for various reasons.
Yeah, we are globally quickly shifting to the right. The book lays out that fascism has always been there, right? And also a narrative reshift that we do is we should not understand the United States as being this wholly liberal and progressive space that has, you know, been at the forefront of fighting fascism when it literally has made the blueprint for fascism in many regards. And so to answer your question of what do we hope folks can take from the book, certainly this history, right? This long historical tradition of folks fighting fascism. And so we hope that empowers people to want to take part and to continue building out this tradition and legacy of being anti-fascist. But moreover, I think the book offers some really good nuggets on how to actually challenge fascism. The chapters on legal anti-fascism, challenging using the law, right? Using art, right? Thinking of going back to the chapter that looks at Jackie Orms and some of the Black anti-fascist cultural front. Organizing mutual aid work, right? Leveraging autonomous zones. Engaging and figuring out what does it look like to organize around anarchy, right? And so I think there are these nuggets also about Black anti-fascist strategy that folks should really sit with as well.
I'll just make two points about the current situation of fascism in the world vis-a-vis our book. I mean, Enzo Traverso has made this argument that, you know, the Muslim of our time is the Jew of earlier times. And one of the things that's holding together the global far right these days is Islamophobia, right? But that Islamophobia is also a reminder of histories of colonialism. Europe does not want Syrian refugees. It wants to colonize Syria, but don't let those folks come across the border and don't let them come in from Africa. So what we see is a kind of return of colonial process, right? Through capitalism's uneven development, we still have refugees from the historical process of colonization who are now the kind of targets of new far-right, anti-immigrant, Islamophobic sentiment across Europe, in Latin America, in North America. So for me, our book speaks to this as a long cycle that never actually quite slows down or goes away. The second thing I'll say is you mentioned what's happening now in Palestine, right? I think our book recovers the We Charge Genocide petition because Black radicals were asking the question, what exactly constitutes a genocide? What are its historical roots? And who are its victims? And this is exactly what the South African tribunal is about, is calling the question of what Israel is doing to Palestinians now as an example of genocide, and insisting, as we insist in our book, that you can only understand genocide by understanding Israel as a settler colonial state. Right? Mm-hmm. That the tactics of checkpoints and walls and barbed wire and Gaza as an open air prison, these are colonial tactics, right? There's a vigorous debate going on even within Israel right now about whether that government is moving towards fascism, is already fascist, and what is going to be the next step. So I think our book, hopefully opening up these questions about the colonial legacies of fascism and its potential, really does bear on the question right now of Israel and Palestine. I'm sure that if William Paterson was around today, I know what side he'd be on. I know he would be arguing, you know, strenuously that what's happening in to the Palestinians is what he would understand as a kind of racialized fascism. Mm.
And I guess when I talked to you a year or so ago, when you talked about James Baldwin before reading your book, I did not know that James Baldwin was also in Israel and witnessed the situation of Palestinians back then in 1960s, if I'm not mistaken, when he was there. Yeah. So that just goes to speak about this tradition of Black anti-fascism.
Yeah, Baldwin actually writes the introduction of a little foreword to that book by Angela Davis that Janelle was talking about, If They Come For Us in the Morning. And the title comes from his essay in which he's waiting in prison, right? He knows that the state would really love to execute her. I mean, that was the whole plan by framing her for murder, was to kill her as a Black revolutionary. And so he compares her to a woman in Dachau preparing to go to the gas chamber, right? And you think, wow, like, you know, the historical resonance of that is so powerful. But it really does, I think, go to that point that Janelle was making about why and how the prison itself, which is always at the heart of fascism, or at least incarceration and the control of the body is at the heart of fascism. Why Baldwin and Davis would have, you know, come to these historical parallels and conclusions.
Mm. Dr. Janelle Hope and Dr. Bill Mullen, thank you very much for your time. Really enjoyed listening to you. It's a fascinating book. Lots of great lessons from the past, but lessons that also we can learn and use today. The book is published by Haymarket, and it will be releasing on 2nd of April this year.
Thanks so much, Marteza.